Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
An Erio's original.
Each week, we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week, you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado-Smith, and this is The Aftermath. The Aftermath. Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Aftermath. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Benjamin Vrad, UCLA lecturer and expert on government and politics in the Middle East, particularly Iran. Let's hear what he has to say about the Iran hostage crisis. Hi, Dr. Vrad. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So can we start off by kind of getting a little background on the U.S.-Iranian relations pre 1950s.
So pre-1950s, out of World War II, the United States and the Soviets and the British had agreed to a sphere of influence that all three would share with regards to Iran. The British and the Soviets in particular used Iran and Iranian resources as both a supply route and a staging ground for their opposition to the Nazis and pushing them back, especially in North Africa, but to prevent them from establishing a foothold. They were concerned that Hitler had become too cozy with Reza Shah, the first monarch in the Pahlavi dynasty. In fact, they had visited Iran and the two leaders had good cordial relations, and the concern was that there would be some sort of axis that'd be formed there. So to prevent that, they had the Shah removed. He agreed, basically, under pressure from the British and the United States and the Soviets, to abdicate. He goes to Egypt in exile, and his son, who is very young at that time, I believe maybe 19 or 20, Mohammad Reza, becomes the de facto leader, the actual leader. And so the United States and Britain and the Soviets now are grooming this young monarch who doesn't really know what he's doing, was unprepared for the role, and ends up basically doing what the great powers want him to do. And that continues really through the end of World War II, and then the war ends. The British and Soviet had agreed to leave once the war was over, but the Soviets lingered, attempted to establish a satellite communist state in the northern part of Iran as a breakaway republic, of which the United States and the British opposed. They took it to the UN. It was actually the first crisis of the Cold War, or one of the first, if not the first. So it really set the stage for what would become U.S.-Soviet relations in the developing world for the remainder of the Cold War. And that happened in Iran. It was known as the Tehran or the Iran crisis.
So then what happens in the early 50s that leads to the 1953 coup that brings down the prime minister? And how is the U.S. involved?
Well, okay, great question. So there was a documentary that just came out a week or so ago, a film called Coup 53, which actually goes over this in great detail. It's a fantastic documentary. Highly recommend it. What happened was Iran at the time is undergoing rapid change as the Soviets as the British Empire is fading. Britain is trying to do its best to hold on to whatever overseas assets it has. Its crown jewel happened to be the Anglo-Iranian or Anglo-Persian oil company, which Britain owned a majority share of and effectively controlled. And it was a lopsided arrangement where the British were given exclusive rights to extract oil from the southwest region of Iran, Khuzestan, and keep most of the profits. Everything from the extraction to the refinement to the sale was done by the British. A little bit was given to Iranians to the Iranian state as compensation, but it was a very unfair deal. And as opposition to this began to grow, a nationalist movement built up in Iran, led by a member of parliament, Mohammad Mossadegh. And Mossadegh, who eventually became prime minister in 1951, on this platform of nationalizing the oil company, did so. He formed a coalition in parliament, was able to essentially declare and undid the prior arrangement that the Iranians had with the British, nationalized the oil company, much to the British's displeasure. To the English, they were very unhappy with it, and they made several attempts to try to dissuade him, to get rid of him, to maneuver around him, to seek support from other members in government, and they initially attempted to have him displaced or overthrown in 51. They couldn't do that on their own. They went to the United States to get help, but President Truman at the time, who had good relations with the Shah, said, look, this is an arrangement you're going to have to live with. It's better that you form a positive relationship with Iran rather than trying to maintain this. He didn't call it an unfair concession, but these terms that existed. When the United States said they were not going to cooperate, the British basically held, by their time, they were expelled from the country by the prime minister, who basically said, look, we don't trust you. You are trying to get rid of me or interfere with our domestic affairs. And British diplomats were banned, so the British operated out of Cyprus, effectively running their diplomacy and foreign policy there with regards to Iran. And they tried again when a new U.S. president, Eisenhower, came into office, who was much more receptive, especially the Dulles brothers. You had John Foster Dulles, who was the U.S. Secretary of State, and Alan Dulles, his brother, who was the director of the CIA. Both of them were very receptive to the idea of putting somebody more favorable and friendly to Britain and the United States as prime minister instead of Mossadegh. So the British resurrected the coup idea and used the United States to really do the on-the-ground work to ultimately make it happen, and resulted in his overthrow, the coup in 1953.
And then the Shah is put into power.
Yeah, so the Shah was in power the whole time. But what happened was, as Mossadegh's appeal and popularity grew exponentially from 51 to 53, the Shah was marginalized and he feared for his own safety. He feared he was somebody who hadn't come into his own since he came into the monarchy after his father was deposed. And so as a result, here he was dealing with this situation that was sort of way out of his league, and he lacked the popular support that he felt he needed. And so for him, he marginalized himself as sort of both a out of maybe from a shame perspective, but also from a safety perspective. So he was the monarch, but power had shifted so much to the prime minister that after the coup, the Shah was able to consolidate that power back and stack parliament with members that were more favorable to him, and you know, restricting which parties were allowed to even run for office so that this situation wouldn't repeat itself again.
So what kind of a ruler does he actually turn out to be?
Authoritarian, simply put. Whether or not, and there's a lot of controversy over whether he was a brutal dictator or whether he was a authoritarian strongman like the kind we've seen throughout the Middle East in decades. And his policies consisted of both some that were very, by modern standards, oppressive, but also very progressive and pro-reform. His 1963 White Revolution, which stirred up a lot of anger amongst the conservative clergy class, meant to modernize the country, meant to bring women into the workforce, meant to increase literacy rates, which were in the 20% before in the 1950s, and all of a sudden jumped up to 70% after his program was implemented. He wanted to bring workers out of the villages and into the cities, modernize the country, liberate and empower women much more than they had been. And the idea was to make Iran more like Europe. So in that sense, he brought tremendous change and opportunity to huge segments of the Iranian population. So he was a progressive or a populist, you can even say. But he coupled that with very authoritarian tendencies, which was also to maintain effectively one-party rule, limited dissent, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, virtually no opposition, and the use of secret police to enforce, using very brutal tactics, torture and other methods, and terror to enforce that system. So on the one hand, if you operated within the rules that he set up, the rigid rules, people did well. But those rules prohibited any real political opposition or any true democratic movement from being born.
So then what are the contributing factors behind the rise of the Ayatollah Khomeini?
Yes.
Did I say that right?
Absolutely.
Oh, wow.
So the 1963 White Revolution, which was it's not an actual revolution, it was sort of a policy revolution. It was the big first step because what the Shah did is he took land in the country was controlled by these large landowners, a lot of them tied to the clergy and to seminaries, because these clergy and these seminaries lived off of donations and contributions, and these landowners were this, so they had this relationship where the wealthy landowners would support or underwrite these big seminaries and the clergies as well. So when the Shah took this land from these big landowners, cut it into pieces and redistributed the land to make it more fair, it undermined a huge base of support for the clergy and the seminary. So they were very opposed to that. There was also the idea of bringing women into the workforce, of educating them, of putting them into positions of relative power, having them as teachers, professors, having them as corporate executives, essentially bringing them out of the home and not veiled, very westernized, very secularized, because the Shah was adamant about modernity being a feature of his rule. This is something that the clergy and the traditional base of Iranians who were uncomfortable with this, they opposed this. So the reactionaries, you can call them. And this planted the seed for a conservative opposition, but the problem was that the Shah and the United States, which now basically became the dominant foreign power after the Soviets and the British were effectively pushed out, the United States was focused on communism. And so the Shah also became focused on that. So their concern was, hey, if there's going to be a threat domestically, it's going to be from Soviet agents or communist sympathizers in Iran. So they turned a blind eye to any other opposition or dissent or any discontent that was fomenting. So if people were pushing for democracy, it was not because they were opposed, it's not because they might have been coming from conservative circles. They were coming from, leftist or pro-communist circles. So that became the sole focus. So the point being was that the Shah simply didn't notice the threat, and neither did the United States. It was a huge failure of intelligence until it was too late.
So then the Shah leaves Iran in 1979. And President Jimmy Carter allows him to enter the U.S. for cancer treatment. Can you explain why this is a controversial move by the U.S. and what went into making it?
Well, when the revolution happened in 1979, so the United States still had diplomatic relations with the new, whatever the new system was going to be. It wasn't an Islamic Republic yet. They were still working on what the government was going to be. Everyone knew that Khomeini would be in charge, or if not, at the top of the power structure. And the United States had an embassy. They had citizens living there. They had relations. The new Iranian leaders, the Islamic revolutionaries, they wanted the Shah returned to Iran to stand trial for a host of charges, including the theft of national wealth, of torture, of all kinds of human rights abuses and other abuses of power. Now, of course, everybody understood that if the Shah were to come back to Iran, he would be executed pretty much. It would be the trial would be a farce. Jimmy Carter and others were aware of this. So when the Shah wanted cancer treatment of the kind which only the United States could really offer, there was a question of, do you allow him in which case then the Iranian government would, the Ayatollah would perceive this as giving refuge or safe haven to the Shah. And it fuels this theory that the United States has been his backer, and that the concern was, is the U.S. plotting something to overthrow the revolution, to reverse the revolution and bring the Shah back? These were all concerns that the revolutionaries had. So from their perspective, if the United States allowed the Shah in, it would validate these conspiracy theories or these fears. So Carter, being a humanitarian, very much wanted to extend that to the Shah. He had good relations with him. The United States was one of his closest allies. And there were conservative members of his cabinet, including Brzezinski, his national security advisor, who absolutely felt it was the right thing to do. Opposition came from other members, in particularly in the State Department, Cyrus Vance, his deputy, Warren Christopher, who were concerned about the existing United States citizens in Iran, the embassy, the staff, and what this could do for U.S.-Iranian relations. So this was this hesitation. But it was difficult for the United States, just for humanitarian reasons, to leave this guy out and to basically not give him what they could to help him stay alive and to fight back his cancer. So it was a difficult debate for Carter, but in the end, he felt he made the right moral humanitarian choice and was prepared to accept the consequences, and we know what those consequences were.
Right. So what was the initial plan of the students to overtake the embassy? What was their goal?
Their goal was to call attention to their cause and to call attention to the fact that they perceived the United States' presence in Iran as what they called a den of spies or a nest of spies. And they wanted the United States to take responsibility and to either apologize or to recognize its role in having brought Iran to the economic or political state that it had been. And so the purpose was not initially to keep the hostages for that long. Now, there's a lot of debate as to whether or not this was planned by Khomeini initially. It appears as if the students sort of did this spontaneously, and then they reached out to Khomeini after they took the embassy to get his blessing for what they did. And then once Khomeini understood what he had in his hands, his group took it over from there. So the students really, even though they remained there as the guards of the embassy, if you will, keeping the hostages in place, it really then moved over to Khomeini's circle. And even the Iranian foreign ministry was marginalized, and many of its members resigned or left out of fear.
So why was Khomeini so reluctant to return the hostages?
Khomeini saw the hostages as a bartering chip. For him, it was a demonstration not only of Iran's new power, so in other words, reversing this imbalance that had existed for so long. It was the United States couldn't do anything, and Khomeini relished this idea that the superpower, so long in his eyes responsible for Iran's political and domestic plight, was now all of a sudden, you know, incapable of rescuing its own citizens. So it was a moment of projecting Iran's newfound authority and power. And then it was attempting to receive concessions from the United States. Now it was, for a while, getting the Shah to come back and using the hostages as a bartering chip, which didn't work. And then later it was to basically have Iranian assets that were in the United States that were frozen by the U.S. government after the embassy was taken over. Iran wanted those assets unfrozen and returned to Iran. A lot of this was the Shah's personal wealth. And from the perspective of the revolutionaries, the Shah had plundered the state's coffers, treasury, and this was the national wealth that was illegally being held in the United States. So the revolutionaries wanted that money returned.
And how do we know how the hostages were treated while they were in captivity?
They were treated, you know, they were subjected to psychological torture, being taken into mock execution rooms where they're blindfolded and a gun would be put to their head without a bullet in the chamber and the trigger is pulled. You hear the click, things of that nature, sleep deprivation. There wasn't a lot of physical abuse or physical torture in the way that we now know takes place in Iran and other countries. But definitely the psychological torment was there. By and large, their captors, depending on who the captors were, some treated them better than others. But overall, it was an unpleasant experience, to say the least. Their freedoms were limited. Their option, you know, their ability to communicate with the outside was, of course, completely limited. But they were not subjected to the kinds of physical tortures that we now are aware of. But absolutely, they endured psychological torture, which was horrific in its own right.
How big of a failure was Operation Eagle Claw?
It was a debacle in the sense that the United States had it was the first time that you had the Delta Force was used for the first time. So it was this use of a U.S. Special Operations Unit. And it was really important to demonstrate that the U.S. had the capability to do this. So it was for sure a national embarrassment, domestically speaking. And then it was one that Iran basically it motivated Iran to continue to do, or it emboldened the leaders to show that, hey, this is how powerless the United States is, or how feckless they are, that they're only that the only attempt to get these hostages out was to use this method, and they couldn't even get that right. So its biggest impact, I believe, was domestically on Carter. I absolutely think that the hostage crisis being as long as it did was one thing, but Carter's inability to, or the failure of the mission of Operation Eagle Claw, all but doomed Carter's fate in that 1979 election, or 1980 election.
Now, I read some allegations that the Chase Manhattan Bank persuaded the Carter administration into allowing the Shah into the U.S. for treatment because he was one of their biggest clients. Should they be shouldering more of the blame here?
Well, I believe the head of Chase Manhattan was Rockefeller at the time, who yes. was who had obviously very strong political connections to the U.S. government, and not only had the Shah as a client, but it's not unusual that we see private businesses and executives from private businesses have such a strong role in U.S. foreign policy. In fact, look at the most recent peace deal between the United Arab Emirates and Israel. Even though it was President Trump and his team that, in theory, facilitated that, we know that Chaim Saban, who is a big Democratic donor and entertainment mogul billionaire, was the one that did a lot of the back work to make this happen. So it's sometimes these diplomatic efforts, track two, they call them, because they're done beneath the first main track. Sometimes they're successful and they work well, and other times they don't. But to say that these corporate titans should be held responsible, I don't think it's that easy, because oftentimes they do effective work to make things happen, and other times it doesn't turn out so well. So it's simply part of the U.S. diplomatic apparatus. At the end of the day, the responsibility falls to the United States government in its formal diplomatic channels.
So why did the Ayatollah finally agree to free the hostages?
That's a great question. On the one hand, it was that we know, for example, that the decision to free the hostages happened minutes after Reagan was inaugurated. So the idea was to completely shame, embarrass, and ridicule Carter to secure his defeat. It was really the first time a foreign power interfered in U.S. elections, and obviously not the last time. First time it was done very effectively, and it was to secure his defeat. What the Ayatollahs and the revolutionaries didn't anticipate was what the Reagan administration would be like. Now, whether Reagan and his team cut a back deal during the campaign to say, hey, if we win, we'll agree to do this or that. I mean, later on, Iran-Contra emerged. We don't know yet. Those documents have not been declassified, so we don't exactly know what communications took place prior to that. But on the surface, it was an attempt to humiliate and undermine Carter and to secure his defeat. And once that was done, and there was an agreement to release, I believe, $1.2 or $3 billion of the money that was frozen, it was held in there was a negotiation done in Algiers that year to release those funds. And once those funds were released and transferred, the hostages would be released. But why Khomeini timed it to just after the inauguration, it's not a coincidence, I don't think.
This might be an impossible question to answer or just too lengthy, but, to the best of your ability, how did this crisis shape today's current diplomatic relations with Iran?
The way that it's shaped the current diplomatic relations, it's one of the things, the severing of diplomatic ties and the mistrust that has come as a result of two countries not being able to talk to each other directly has brought us to the state where we are today. Iran's revolution has three pillars that it stands on. One of its pillars is independence from the West. Another of its pillars is to spread the revolution wherever it can. And the third one is this staunch anti-American, anti-Israel position that it has. If any one of those three pillars is removed, then the revolutionary edifice undermines and it falls apart. So for the Iranian regime in its current form, it cannot reestablish ties with the United States, normalize relations, without completely undermining one of its founding principles. So That's the first challenge, where even if the United States were willing to, with little or no preconditions, reestablish talks with Iran, for the Iranian government to do that would be to basically say, yeah, you know, one of those three pillars that we said is important to us? Well, we're going to completely ignore that. That it simply, it becomes hard for them to maintain credibility with their own domestic constituency, which they already have trouble doing. So that's the huge issue. Everything about U.S.-Iranian diplomacy today has to go back to how can the leadership do this credibly and still save face with their own people?
So at the end of the day, finally, if you had to blame one person or thing that for the Iranian hostage crisis, who or what would that be?
If I had to blame one, political scientists, and we don't like to do blame one person or one thing. It was a complicated series of factors, and a lot of it had to do with the Shah's rapid economic policies and rapid economic development that took place in the 70s, but uneven political development. And a lot of that was supported by Richard Nixon and later Ford. So they planted a lot of the seeds that enabled the Shah to got to where he did. The United States focused solely on the Soviets. It didn't look at any Islamic opposition. So there was a failure of U.S. intelligence. The Shah relied on U.S. intelligence oftentimes and his own intelligence services, but the United States should have seen this coming, and it didn't see this at all. So I would say that it was a failure of both the United States and Iran in the early to mid-1970s to understand the grievances and discontent and also where the opposition really was. It wasn't coming from pro-Soviet communist members in Iran. It was coming from a different group of people.
They could have used a really good couples therapist.
There you go. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, they could have used that. Oh, yeah.
Well, Dr. Rad, thank you so much for joining us today and really helping us understand this very complicated, situation and the history behind it. I'm very grateful.
Thank you for having me.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With us today, we have producer Amanda Lund.
Hello.
Fact checker Chris Smith.
Hello, hello.
And that's everyone we have today. how about Dr. Rad? I mean, that was a crash course in Iranian U.S. 20th century history.
I mean, it really was. I've never met anyone so versed on a subject before, but he was awesome. And I felt like he clarified a few things we were a little murky on in our episode.
That's right. I wrote down a bunch of stuff. But for the first part, I really liked his clarification on how the Shah was really as a leader, because I feel like we weren't sure one way or the other. And I think his answer was he was good and bad.
Yeah, well, he was good in the sense that he tried to modernize. He had progressive ideas. But yeah, he, like Dr. Rad said, he totally did not bring the country along sort of politically or culturally. He sort of tried to just fast forward things a little too quickly. And, you know, when you're rushing to get out of the house, although who does that these days because we're all stuck in the house in the pandemic, but you remember way back before the pandemic when you would rush out of the house and you'd just like forget a sock or something, or, you know, you forget to brush your teeth. Or
maybe
like,
your keys.
You know, I sometimes forget to put on my mascara or something. You just mm-hmm. like go out into the world and you're just not ready for it. That's sort of what I thought of.
Yeah, he didn't have the right mascara. It was too flaky.
He didn't bring her on along.
Yeah, I think actually my impression was that we went too easy on the Shah because we didn't really even go into him that much. But I mean, he definitely, it was also like he was part of the whole controversy of coming to America. Like, we really talked about it only from Reagan's perspective. Oh, sorry, Jimmy Carter's perspective of letting him in. Well, the Shah probably knew if he went to America, his whole country would go insane.
Yeah, there is that, dare I say, narcissistic element to him, just being like, I mean, but it's hard to put yourself in his shoes. I mean, he's dying of cancer at the end of the day. Wouldn't we all want to live, right?
Yeah, and you can't blame someone for trying to survive. He knew if he stayed in Iran, which I pronounced Iran, and then Dr. Rad did tell me it's Iran.
Can I make one very obnoxious, pedantic request, and please forgive me if it comes off that way. It's the first thing I tell my students. Is please pronounce it Iran and not Iran. The joke is, and most don't get the reference, Iran is an 80s song by Flock of Seagulls. Iran is a country. So there you go.
But anyway, so you can't blame him for wanting to survive, because he definitely, as we learned, would have been executed had he stayed.
Right.
Right. I would also say we maybe could have used another, thrown the British government on there, because early on they tried to stage that coup before the 53 coup. They were like, hey guys, they kept nudging America, being like, hey, don't you guys want to like overthrow Iran? Like, wouldn't that be cool? And in a British accent, of course. But
right.
But we were like, no, bro, like get out of here. And then eventually they were like, hey, here's that idea again. And we were like, okay, this is in our best interest. So Britain sort of was the sneaky middleman. They were sneaky sort of.
They often are.
Well, it always sounds like a good idea with a British accent.
Well, they're just
you know?
So charming about it.
Yeah,
it's like they present these ideas. Would you like a spot of tea at 4 p.m.? You know, you're like, yes, I'd love whatever you're selling me. I'd love it.
Yeah, we tend to fall for it.
And then also, by the way, like we kind of missed the boat a little bit, I think, on communism, too, because although we did have something like that up there, did we have anything like communism up there?
We didn't have communism. And, you know, I'm shocked because I love to put communism up on the board. But I think that there were so many elements to this crisis that I guess it could have been a six-part series.
Yeah. That's true. Well, it sounds like there is a new documentary out that we could all check out.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
But I do think we should have put communism or the United States obsession with communism up on the board, because it sounds like this was all happening right under their noses and no one saw the writing on the wall.
Yeah, they were communist obsessed.
Yeah,
they kind of left the conservative reactionaries off the hook. That's what I understood. You know, another thing. Another thing that he mentioned was our Carter's, what do you call it? The person who helps Carter.
Chief of staff?
Or advisors. Jeez.
Oh, yeah.
words sometimes
aren't
easy. But he brought up Brzezinski, I think is his name,
yeah.
which we had, you know, put up on the board. But that was a major fail on his part. And I thought it was interesting that he brought up the Reagan administration and how it's unknown whether there was this, you know, secret handshake behind the scenes so that the Iranians can could help him win the presidency. That would be scandalous.
Yeah, echoes of the Trump-Russia deal and all of his sort of back-channel stuff.
It blows my mind how history just keeps repeating itself.
Well, we're trying to make that stop once and for all with this podcast. We're about 100 and some odd episodes in. How many are
Not
we
Not yet, Chris.
50 something?
Well, if you include the aftermaths, we're inching up to 100.
Yeah.
So, Rebecca, what do you think? Like, so this is who we sent to jail. We sent American B&E, breaking and entering, and the Ayatollah to jail. And then did we give the big slap to the advisors?
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
I actually think he put it differently. Dr. Rad put it differently, where he said, you know, U.S. and Iranian like relations, but that and we put it more like, you know, U.S.'s like desire to go into a country and control it at slash the Ayatollah Khomeini. I guess we were kind of circling around the same thing, but I do think that the U.S.'s inability to work with the Iranians is ultimately what led us here.
Mm.
Well, I mean, that that's true. I mean, I guess it's tricky because we were working with them and then this was the result.
Right. So maybe bad communication skills.
Yeah. I mean, I still kind of like our verdict.
I think so, too. I mean, it gets the job done.
Well, you know, Dr. Rad is a, what did he call? He's a professor and he's a sociologist, right? And he has a different, you know, he's looking for a different outcome than we are. His you know, he's not drawing conclusions, but we need to. Like, we're on the front lines of this battle. The podcasting yeah. community needs us. They need us to make definitive decisions and stand by it. And at the end of the day, we need to turn that key and lock the door and stand by it.
Yeah.
So
it's a very diplomatic response to be like, oh, the relations, you know. No, we're going to do...
we just need
well,
to throw...
he said the Shah's rapid economic development... and his slow political development, as well as the United States not picking up on this conservative movement. Those were sort of the two main things that he cited.
Right, right.
So there's a lot of nuance. There's a lot of cause and effect. But, you know, at the end of the day, only a few people can go to jail because we did send two. we already kind of cheated.
Right. We couldn't. Yeah. I like that we sent both of them to jail. That feels good.
Well,
so
the Shah, we kind of just took our, not the Shah, I'm sorry.
Khomeini,
uh-huh. We kind of took our opportunity there just because of all of his shitty policies towards women and homosexuals and just being generally shitty. So we just threw him in there, just that. But I wouldn't say he's necessarily, you know, as responsible for the hostage situation per se as call it like the Shah was and sort of Shah
right.
U.S.
He
relations.
Saw an opportunity.
Yeah, he's sort of more of an opportunist.
Yeah. I mean, it depends if you're looking macro or micro because, you know, he is the one who jumped in and made it turn into the big crisis it was. You know, it wasn't necessarily going to play out for 444 days. We wouldn't be doing this episode probably if they had just been released in 24 hours.
True.
That way, I do like that we sent him to jail as well.
All right. Then I stand by. Why don't we stand by our decision? It sounds, you know.
Stand by your choice.
Show them.
I didn't want to say man because I hate that song.
yeah, I agree. But real quick before we go, I want to just read us because we've gotten two amazing reviews on Apple Podcasts. So here's one that comes in from Wesley the Bestly, 5 stars. Love the show. However, .. Love the format and the show. However, don't be so hard on Fidel Castro and Cuba.
Oh,
that was it? No,
that's his beef.
Okay. And now here's another really great one. Okay, this is, comes in from 73RR90 and... no alarm needed. 5 stars. Great podcast. Some social talking, but not half the show. Gets to the point rather quickly. Thank you.
I love our listeners.
Me too.
They're the best.
They are.
Well, I will still continue to, you know, have my beef with Castro no matter what, no matter what. And I will also continue to try and keep it snappy. Okay, good. Well, I'm glad we got Dr. Rad on the horn. He was awesome. And stay tuned, because next week we are going to be covering Prohibition, and it's going to be our live recording of the show. So, there will be some flubs. I wonder what those flubs will be.
Only exciting. Time will tell.
Amanda, are you planning any flubs? I have a few flubs planned for myself.
Oh, you do? Good. Yeah, I have a couple of pratfalls.
I'm thinking about learning the foxtrot, because that was...
I would love to see you two foxtrotting.
Is it a two-person dance? I was planning on doing it solo.
No, it's definitely two-person.
That's so sad.
I mean, they don't call it the fox's trot. It's not the... Whatever.
It's okay, Chris. It's okay.
Powered by Acast.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus... Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.